Hello, and welcome to Eyes on Success, a weekly program of information on the ever-changing world of accessibility. Now here are the hosts of this program, Nancy Goodman-Torpey and Peter Torpey.
Hello, I'm Nancy.
And I'm Pete. Well, screen readers and other technologies have given blind and visually impaired folks great access to their computers and the programs on the computers and the software on their computers. But what about when it comes to the hardware? Some people may feel a little bit more reticent if they can't see in terms of dealing with the hardware.
This week, we'll speak with Mobeen Iqbal, who has years of experience repairing both desktop and laptop computers and has even built several computers from scratch. We'll talk with him about how he manages to do that in spite of being totally blind. But first, for our tip of the week. This week's tip comes from Mo Iqbal.
When people talk to me, they're like, how do you know all this stuff? And I keep telling them, you know, this is the kind of problems that I've faced over the years and the solutions that I've found, you know, because sometimes sighted help hasn't been around. So I've had to take the cover off my PC. I've had to look inside what the issue is. I've had to try and find a solution as to why, for example, something isn't powering on or something isn't loading. And that in itself can be interesting, and it can inspire you to make yourself better, as well as, you know, trying to make other people's lives better, because you can publish that research on the internet.
And I think he's right. Sometimes we find solutions out of necessities. There aren't always people around to help us do what we want to do. And so Mo, in this case, has figured out ways of doing some of those things. And in the rest of the show, we'll hear about some of his tips.
Let's start by meeting Mobeen Iqbal and learning about how he first got involved in working with computer hardware.
My name is Mobeen Iqbal, and people call me Mo for short. And some of you may have heard me on previous Eyes on Success shows covering topics such as Linux and the Raspberry Pi. I'm 26, and I'm from Lincolnshire in the UK.
When did you first develop an interest in computer hardware and electronics?
I've been into hardware from a very young age. My grandfather, from the age of six, he's an electrician. So ever since I was small, I was strongly encouraged by him. And I used to follow him around, poking my fingers into everything. And, you know, he used to service his own cars, and he used to wire up all his own appliances and everything and do favors for people. And I always wanted to get into electronics in some way, and I always wanted to be part of this hardware scene, but I didn't know how to do it. And I'd always been into computers as well, and, you know, playing computer games from the age of seven.
You said you've been following your electrician grandfather around even as a very young child. You were blind already at that point, right?
Yes. Yeah. I mean, I've been totally blind since shortly after I was born. So my grandfather, he was one of the people that just sort of helped me to tag along with him. And he had quite a lot of respect for me being blind, because one of the challenges for him, he tells me, was trying to find ways that I could achieve something, you know, trying to find ways that I could do something which wasn't ordinarily possible for a totally blind person to do. He was basically fascinated by the whole idea. And that's how it all started. Mm-hmm.
So following your grandfather around is a little bit different than learning to deal with computer hardware. How did you actually get into computer hardware? What was your background?
Throughout my time, you know, in school, I was actually given the job of maintaining their systems, you know, to an extent, on and off. So, you know, they'd send me around school with a screwdriver and say, look, you know, can you get this thing done? And then I'd replace components or whatever, obviously under supervision. It wasn't totally on my own, which was understandable. And when I reached college, the course that I was actually talked into doing by the college was business studies, how to start your own business. I didn't actually do any, you know, IT course specifically to do with PC programming or whatever, because they didn't offer it. You know, this was a College for the Blind in the UK, the Royal National College for the Blind in Hereford. So, no, I've not done a course in computer programming or hardware. I'm a totally self-taught hardware technician. And after I'd left school and college, I did voluntary work for a PC recycling company. And the guy running that actually had an eye condition. And he was sympathetic to my plight. And he just said, look, you know, if you can do the job, I'm willing to employ you on a voluntary basis. You know, I'm going to try you out. And I was given the job of cleaning the systems, maintaining them, you know, refitting them before reallocation. So it was a really interesting introduction. And, you know, while all that was going on, I was building my own systems in my home and everything and teaching myself more and more about the components inside a computer. And that's, in a nutshell, how I got into hardware.
You are listening to Eyes on Success. 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 Success.
This week's focus topic is how it's possible to work with computer hardware as a blind person.
So today we mostly wanted to talk about how a visually impaired person can negotiate working with computer hardware.
Yeah, I mean, in a situation like this, my philosophy has always been, it's not that we can't do something, we have to do it in a different way, you know? I mean, visually impaired people can even drive, which is very impressive. Well, okay, they may need adapted cars, they may need somebody there as backup, but it's possible, you know?
Before we get into talking about how you work on a computer, can you describe what the main components are of a computer? What's inside those boxes?
In terms of computer hardware, the computer consists of baseline components that haven't really changed much in the last 15, 20 years. In a nutshell, inside that box that's probably sat next to most of you while you're listening to this, you have a power supply, which is a big square metal box with loads of wires coming out of it, and that is responsible for providing most of the power to all the various bits of your computer. You have a hard disk drive, which is a flat piece of metal, basically. I mean, it's a flat metal box, about 3.5 inches in width. That is responsible for holding all your data, all the things that you do on the computer, all the files that you save. And the central processing unit, or CPU, is, well, they're getting smaller and smaller now, actually, but it's a little square inch-by-inch piece of silicon, and that is actually responsible for carrying out all the instructions to make things happen on your computer. So when you press a key on your keyboard, that will respond. That's the brain of the computer, and it will tell the computer what to do. You know, so Mo's pressed space, so let's end this call. No, not going to do that. And the other part of the computer is the motherboard. It's a board about 22 inches by 20 inches, roughly. Nowadays, they're coming in different sizes. You know, you can get big ones, small ones, depending on your system configuration. Servers have huge motherboards, whereas your home computer might just have a board which is 12 by 12 inches. And this board is responsible for housing all the components and linking them all together. So, you know, it links your hard drive together. It links, you know, your USB ports together that you plug things into. It, you know, provides you with network access. And everything fits onto the motherboard. So if we have a look at how a system is built, what you start off with is an empty box, an empty metal box, nothing inside it whatsoever. And the first thing that you have to insert into that box is the motherboard, because you have to have something. It's like building a house foundation. So you've got to have something to build onto and put things onto. So the motherboard contains slots and connectors which are all different. You know, you don't get the same connector for hard drives, for example, and floppy drives. They would not have shared the same baseline connector.
Now, for someone who can't see, and this may be their first time getting into the hardware of a computer, how would you recommend they get started?
To a blind person trying to get into hardware, I'd recommend, first of all, having somebody sighted there with you, and perhaps getting hold of an old computer from somewhere. And when you take the side off the computer, you will actually see the board. And if you take each component off it, you know, bit by bit, for example, obviously build a PC in reverse, as it were. So first of all, take out the USB cards or network cards, which are cards, mini boards, if you like, that just slot onto the main board. You will feel that each of those cards has a different type of connection on there. So in other words, you couldn't just put the card in the wrong way around. You would have to actually, you know, feel the slot that the card's going into. And then wherever the card slot corresponds to the card, that's what you'd fit the card into. And the same goes for something like computer memory.
Okay, so now that we know about the computer a little bit, I guess one of the more important things is about the memory in the computer. That is something that people are likely to want to upgrade. Can you talk a little about that?
When you take the side off your computer and you look inside, RAM chips are long chips, and they slot into your board. They only slot in one way. And each one of those chips has a certain value. So, for example, you may have two chips on your board, which combined provide you with 4 GB of system memory. And system memory is the space that, for example, all your tasks have to spread out in. So the more memory you have, the happier Windows is, because it's got more space to spread out. It's like giving somebody a bigger room, you know, or a bigger house. We all want a bigger house. So, you know, the more space you have to spread out, the better it is.
And you can often speed up a computer quite a bit by just adding more RAM.
Yeah, exactly. Because if more things can happen at the same time, the PC is happier as well. Whereas if you've got minimal memory, what your PC has to do is constantly copy stuff in and out of this memory.
So now you've been describing the RAM as a chip, but in my experience, it's a very small board that's maybe 6 inches long, and it's got maybe 8 individual chips on it, each of which is maybe a half an inch by an inch. And those are the individual memory chips. But you buy the set as an integrated small board.
Yes. Yeah.
Well, I think in the old days, you used to insert the individual chips to add memory. But these days, you're often adding a memory board where the chips are pre-inserted.
That's right. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, these days, all the chips are integrated on one board itself.
Well, that's a great idea to learn on an old computer about tactily what's inside a computer and what it all feels like in there. And we all know there's probably plenty of old computers lying around in people's closets or down basements.
Or at your local electronics recycling center. That's a great place to get a computer that you really don't have to worry about whether you put it back together again properly.
And that way you can learn to identify all these components just tactily. And as you say, there are just certain ways they'll fit together with the different slots and sockets that they have.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not going to go into all the terminology of the internal connectors on a computer here because, you know, of time constraints. But what you'll find is, for example, hard drives and CD drives use the same type of cable and power connector. So in other words, you're not going to get mixed up between the two because they feel totally different inside a computer. You know, the hard drive is typically mounted below the CD drive. So if you feel around the front of the computer, feel your CD drive, and slide your finger around the side, and then feel inside the computer case, you can quite easily find out where the CD drive actually is. It's like a mini DVD player, if you like. You know, a smaller version of a DVD player fixed inside your computer, and you'll be able to feel where that is and the wires going into the back of it. And the hard drive, as we were saying earlier, is a device about 3.5 by roughly about 4 or 5 inches, and it's like a flat box which is mounted below the CD drive. And if you buy an old computer, again, you'll be able to feel where the connectors for that drive are. And the one thing which I will mention, though, is the older connectors were called IDE connectors. It was a bunch of pins, about 24 pins, on the back of a hard drive or a CD drive. And one common issue we always used to have, and this was sighted people and visually impaired people as well, when building PCs, was that you'd bend the pins when you were trying to plug the cable into the back of the drive.
So you do have to be a little gentle.
You did have to be very gentle when IDE connectors were all the rage when plugging stuff in. And the same still applies, actually, when you're plugging a monitor into the back of your PC. I've actually bent pins on my monitor cable as well. So, you know, things are pretty fragile these days as well sometimes. But the IDE connector was replaced with something called the SATA connector or serial ATA. And the serial specification was a connector which was a lot smaller and a lot more rigid. So, you know, depending on which PC you pick up at these yard sales or wherever, it may or may not have an IDE connection inside. And the IDE cable will feel like a big, flat, wide ribbon cable. Whereas if it's a SATA cable, it will be a very thin cable. You know, it'll be, I don't know, 1/4 inch in width. And that will be very obvious because it's a very, very thin, flat cable that you can feel going to the back of your drive and your CD drive. And most systems built these days in the last, I don't know, 5 to 10 years have those cables inside.
Now, once you've learned about the internal components of a computer by working on an old computer or a used computer, and you want to start working on a new computer to maybe add some memory or swap out disk drives, there are some considerations. For example, I would certainly start with the thing unplugged, but also people worry about electrostatic issues and grounding oneself. Can you talk about that a little?
Sure, yeah. I mean, when you're working on a PC, it's always recommended to wear an earth grounding strap. And these can be picked up very cheaply from any reputable hardware store or online. If you want to discharge yourself, one trick which I always use is rub your hands on your PC case, you know, a few times, and that will actually get rid of any current which you might yourself contain. It's very unlikely. But yeah, as you were saying, Pete, always unplug your system. I've worked on systems in the past and been arrogant in a way, and thinking that I could actually work on it with the power supply plugged in, and I've blown one up. So don't make the same mistake I made.
Well, and the other issue, the reason for grounding yourself, even if you do unplug the computer, is you don't want to statically discharge to the computer and blow up a chip accidentally.
Exactly, which is also something that I've done. So this was all while I was learning. You know, it happens to the best of us.
Right.
You're speaking from experience
right
here.
The other important factor that people who've never done this before won't even think of, but anybody who's been doing hardware maintenance for years will resonate with this comment. Possibly the most difficult part of the task is going to be opening the case. And back in the day when every time Pete got a new computer, whether it was at home or at work, and he needed a new sound card because things were done in hardware, I'd have to figure out how to open the case in order to swap in the right boards. And every single one is different, and very few of them are easy to open, unless you get lucky.
Yeah, I mean, this is one thing which is extremely annoying, you know, when you're working on multiple machines. Dell and HP have a totally different method on their cases for actually opening the cases. Some cases you can open quite easily. Some cases are actually a nightmare to get into, as you were saying. So, again, have somebody sighted, just double check, just in case there is, you know, a diagram on the side of the case telling you how to get in there. Because believe me, I've tried, and I've actually broken cases doing that. So, you know, out of frustration that nobody was there. It doesn't happen very often, and nowadays I know what to look for on PC cases. But when you're learning, it can very easily happen. You know, you can easily bend parts of the case, or you can snap screws that are inside, because quite often when you can't see, this has happened to me a lot as well, there'll be a screw, you know, that is hidden, if you like, to your fumbling fingers. And normally you take that screw out and that would make taking the side off easier. But because you don't know it's there, you're just forcing it, thinking, why isn't this thing coming off?
By the same token, I've often thought that sometimes a visually impaired person had the advantage in that arena, because often those screws and latches are hidden from sight because they don't want to destroy sort of the look of the box. And so sighted people who are used to looking for those things don't see them. But, you know, if you're blind, you're more used to the tactile sensation of pulling things apart. And you can sometimes have a feel for where those screws and hidden latches are.
You're absolutely right. Yeah, sometimes sighted people haven't been able to even help out.
Oh, I absolutely agree with that. I can't begin to count the number of times I've had to ask Pete to help find screws and similar things.
The one other thing to watch out for when you're buying components is always check compatibility with your manufacturer, because there are multiple specifications, especially for memory. You know, you've got DDR1 specification, which was around about 10 to 15 years ago. Then you've got DDR2, which was around 5 to 10 years ago. And DDR3, which is what we're on now. And there's even DDR4 and DDR5. Manufacturers generally call RAM by their specification and speed. And it, you know, there's no common naming convention for RAM apart from the type. So in other words, like DDR3. So there's different speeds of DDR3. So always check with your system manufacturer.
That is great advice. In fact, I just recently upgraded the RAM on my laptop, basically so I could do audio editing for Eyes on Success. You know, the easiest way to figure out which memory was going to be compatible with my device was I just Googled it. I'm like, find me some memory for my device by product name and number.
Yeah, I mean, Google is a technician's best friend. You know, the amount of information on the internet is absolutely insane. And there are manufacturers, for example, like Kingston, Crucial, who actually have memory checkers on their websites. So if you go on the website and type in the model number of your computer, you can often get it checked, or they often have utilities as well that you download. If you run the utility, it often tells you on the screen which type of memory you have, and it gives you a link to buy it as well. So that can be another way of upgrading the chip.
Now, sometimes these chips can be a little bit difficult to replace. Do you have any tips on physically how to do that?
The chip can only go in one way. If it doesn't go in the first time, don't force it. Turn it around and try it the other way. There's a clip on either end. You sort of pull them away from each other before you insert the chip, or to even to eject a chip that's in there currently. You know, again, so you'd have to pull those out, slide the chip in, and that's it, really. And obviously, I'll do all this with the system powered off. And when you power your system on, hopefully it'll give you a notification to say, hey, you added some more memory.
This may be a totally useless comment to make to a blind audience, but in particular, those memory cards go in at a funny angle. And so I would recommend, before you take out the old one, to feel the orientation of what you're taking out so you know the orientation of how to put something back in.
You're absolutely right. Yeah, with laptops, it's slightly different. You know, the most common things that people replace on their laptops are either the hard drive or the memory chip. And we'll touch on that very briefly in a moment. But memory chips, going back to what you were saying, on a laptop, they're going at 45 degrees. On most laptops at the back, you have a small square cover with a screw holding it in place. And when you unscrew that cover, we're going to have everybody opening up their PCs now, won't we? But when you unscrew that cover, underneath that cover are normally either one or two memory chips on average. Or the slot may be empty even, just in case, you know, the memory isn't housed in a different part of your PC, because some manufacturers choose to mount their main memory chip under the keyboard. which is what people aren't going to replace. But if you want to add more memory, they will leave an empty slot for you at the back very generously so you can put more memory in. There's normally a notch on the chip that you're putting in. So if you feel the notch on the chip compared to the notch in the slot that you're putting the card into, you can generally feel the orientation. This only applies to laptops. On desktops, there is a notch, but you can't feel it. And when you slide the chip in at 45 degrees, you'll generally feel it go into the slot snugly. And then you can press it down with your fingers gently and you'll hear it click into place. And you can put the cover back on. And replacing your hard drive, most PC manufacturers either offer a section of the laptop that you can unscrew, again, another square flap, and underneath that will be your hard drive, or they offer a hard drive bracket, if you like, which is one screw holding the main hard drive in place. So when you unscrew that screw on your laptop and slide the hard drive out, the whole hard drive will come out attached to the small plastic section which you unscrewed. So, you know, that will be a bracket which holds the hard drive in place, so you can replace the hard drive for a bigger one. And this is always something which I wish I could show people, because it's not something you can just grasp overnight. You know, I mean, most people will probably try not to open their systems, but some people will. And if you're adventurous, go ahead, but just be prepared just in case you do break something. Because believe me, when I first started doing this, I was probably breaking more than I was fixing.
Well, thanks. You shed a lot of light on what's inside of computer and given us a lot of tips about upgrading our computer and changing some of the components. But how about if you're building a system from scratch? There must be some different issues involved there.
And when you're building a system from scratch, one thing which I will mention is if you've never ever done it before, you have to have somebody sighted there to tell you. For example, there's a fan on top of your processor which cools it down. And there are two or three connectors normally that they'll provide on the main motherboard for fans to plug into. If you plug it into the wrong fan, you will receive an error on startup saying that the processor fan could not be detected. So you have to make sure that you're plugging everything into the right connectors. And this is the only area that you need sighted help. In other words, connecting things to the main board, for example, like your fan connector, and also the buttons on the front of your computer case. There is no standardization for which connectors those buttons should use or what order they should go in on various boards. Each board has different pins for these little buttons to attach to. And I always have to get sighted help for somebody to attach those buttons to the board for me, because otherwise you can't turn the PC on. So that's the only part of the process which I think does need sighted help. And obviously when you first turn the PC on, different manufacturers have different welcome screens. So you've got no idea what's going to come up. So again, you know, although the process is like 85 to 90% without sight, you do still need sighted backup, in all honesty. Once the PC is built, you're fine. Once you know what's inside your own computer, you're absolutely fine, but it's just getting to that stage.
Do you have any resources where people can go either on the net or otherwise to learn more if they're interested in how to do some of these tasks?
Well, if, for example, I wanted to look how to replace a PC keyboard, for example, on a laptop, or you know, wanted to know how to install memory inside a certain model of computer, if you type that model into Google and type in, for example, replacing keyboard HP 6910P, you will often get YouTube videos, and you may even get a text how-to. So somebody may have written it up with screenshots. So, for example, they will say, turn the computer over, take the battery out. Underneath the battery, you will find three screws. Remove those. Remove the screws on the base of the laptop, which have an arrow next to them, which sometimes you can feel. Using those basic guides, I've been able to, you know, do things on laptops without breaking too many of them, because you can never assume anything with laptops. Each laptop is different. So every time somebody gives me a PC to fix, I have to go and read a guide. And generally those guides are available all over the place. There isn't a specific website that you can go to where, you know, you'll have guides for all laptops. The best thing you can do is a Google search.
So let Google be your friend.
Exactly, exactly. Google has been my best friend over the years.
Well, it certainly sounds like you enjoy working with computers, Mo.
Not a day goes by when I don't learn something new about the tech that we're using now, because so much new stuff's coming out. And specifications are changing every single year, you know, for different things. So it's a very interesting game to get into, but it can also be a very frustrating one at times.
Now for this week's final item, Raspberry Vi, a tiny and very inexpensive computer that's really just begging for the user to be playing with its hardware as well as its software, and then also how to reach Mo if you want to ask him any questions. We did a show with you about a year ago talking about the Raspberry Vi, which is the version of the Raspberry Pi for the visually impaired. Can you just give like a really quick summary of what that is? And if anybody wants to know more, we'll refer them back to the prior show.
The Raspberry Pi is a mini computer, and maybe your listeners would like to build one of those first. They're very easy. You can buy kits where you can build your own Pi, and it's a self-contained mini board about the size of a pack of cards or a pack of cigarettes. A typical Raspberry Pi has two USB ports on it, a connection to a television, and an audio out connection, a connection for a network, so you can plug a wired network connection into the Pi. It is powered by any device which can send power over USB. So you could plug it into your computer's USB port and you could power it off that, or you could plug it into the mains and power it off a USB mains adapter. And this computer is designed, it was designed originally to teach children programming in schools, but it's turned into an amazing piece of kit with many applications. For example, people have made computer-controlled helicopters. They've made weather stations, which they can control from inside, you know, on their main computer. And it runs Linux. It runs custom versions of Linux from an SD card, which are found all over the place in cameras and all kinds of different devices. And you can do almost anything with a Pi, you know, with the processing power that it provides. It isn't designed to be a replacement for a desktop computer. So you can't sort of, you know, expect it to have a lovely desktop interface with, you know, nice flashing icons. Yes, one does exist. Yes, they do provide a basic desktop interface. You can browse the web. It can even play high definition video, which is very impressive. But, you know, in terms of getting speech running on there for the blind, what we have actually managed to do recently is get speech running without any delay at all, without any problems, from a command prompt. So you don't have access to a desktop interface, but what you do have access to is an MS-DOS-like interface, if you like. Most people will be familiar with that, I think. And you can type in various commands to do things like edit text files, browse the internet with a text browser, check emails, anything that you'd normally be able to do, but without actually launching a fully-fledged desktop.
Now, we don't normally discuss prices of products on this show, but in this case, the price is so low, it's worth mentioning, because just in case you're thinking that it might be a barrier to purchasing one, it's only about $30 or $40 to get one. So that's hardly a barrier.
And if people wanted to contact you to ask more about some of these projects and about building computers, what is your email address?
It's mobeen@iqbal.me.uk. So mobeen at iqbal.me.uk. And generally speaking, if anybody's got any questions about getting started with hardware and I can answer them briefly, then I'm more than willing to help.
And as usual, we'll have links to all of that information about the Raspberry Pi and Mo's contact information. And he also mentioned that he appeared in an earlier episode of Eyes on Success about Vinix. Vinix is a totally accessible version of the Linux operating system, accessible right out of the box. So you might want to learn more about that. So anyway, if you want to find out any of that information, go to www.eyesonsuccess.net and look for the show notes for this episode.
That's it for show number 1509. Next week on Eyes on Success, we'll be talking with Hobie Wedler, a blind graduate student in chemistry, about a chemistry camp for blind teenagers that he founded and runs annually to share his love of science with youth. We'll review some of the highlights of each session, including some unexpected things attendees learn. If you have any questions regarding something you've heard about on the show, or you'd like to share an idea for a future show, send an email to hosts@eyesonsuccess.net or call us at 585-258-0333.
You've been listening to Eyes on Success, hosted and produced by Nancy Goodman Torpey and Peter Torpey and distributed by WXXI Reach Out Radio. For detailed information or a full archive of programs, visit www.eyesonsuccess.net. You can also follow us on Facebook and on audioboom.com at Eyes on Success or Twitter at @_EyesOnSuccess. We hope you will join us again next week for more information and updates on products for accessible living. Thanks for listening to Eyes on Success and have a nice day.